for old age. And also with HIV and the AIDS burden, people are living longer, but also there are comorbidities, and so the NCDs are developing particularly fervently within our context. Now, what this graph shows here is that the majority of people now in South Africa are dying from non-communicable diseases. You can see that a couple of years ago, when the HIV epidemic was at its highest, the greatest number of people in South Africa were dying through HIV and AIDS. But now, as we have got better control of this disease, proportionately, the numbers of people who are dying of non-communicable diseases is rising. And therefore, at present, we say more people are dying of non-communicable diseases, and therefore, we have to focus on it again. We have to do something drastic, because many of these deaths are preventable, as it was the case with HIV, and as it still is with HIV. But we need to really get in and forget about the fact that this is a burden of the rich, or we have another crisis in South Africa. We have a triple burden of diseases, and one of these is non-communicable diseases, and that is currently killing the most people. Let's just have a little bit of a breakdown. The prevalence of hypertension is very high in South Africa. You can see here that it does increase as people get older. But the fact that people as young as 5 to 24 year age group have high levels, what we would consider to be worldwide high levels of hypertension, going up to the 25 to 34 group, 15% with hypertension, that's huge, okay? And we really need to prevent as soon as possible, as early as possible. Similarly with diabetes or glucose homeostasis, these two lines show what we call pre-diabetes and diabetes. Again, for those of you who would know or be able to compare with world figures, these figures are high, okay? And we cannot neglect, for example, that even in the 15 to 24-year-old group, about 4% are actually pre-diabetic. That's very young. Going up to the 55 to 65-year-old age, where about 24% are diabetic, and a further 13.9 or 14% pre-diabetic. So you can actually see that many, many people in South Africa are actually impacted by these non-communicable diseases. This is driven not exclusively, but importantly, by being overweight and obese. And the prevalence of obesity in South Africa, again, is extremely high. If we look at males in terms of obesity, it's around about 10%. In females, it's about 40%. So this is something that we really need to worry about. But it's also a worry in children, where you can actually see that large numbers of children as young as in the 2 to 5 year age group are already overweight and obese. So this problem is starting at a very young age, and as I said earlier, is carrying on right through until old age. Let's now look at sugar consumption, because that's why we are all here. The intake of added sugar is increasing steadily in South Africa, with children consuming about 40 to 60 grams a day, increasing to about 100 grams in adolescence. According to the South African Cane Growers Association, sugar consumption in South Africa is about 32 kilograms per person per year, equaling about 88 grams a day. This is also far, far too high, far higher than is recommended by World Health Organization and others, and we will hear later from the World Health Organization exactly what their recommendations are. The health system is burdened by NCDs too. I believe that this probably will come up in further presentations, and given my pressure, perhaps I'll just skip through this, other than to say that if a person develops a non-communicable disease, or if they are obese, they become high burdens on the health system. Chronic diseases are lifelong. So if a person develops hypertension, for example, or diabetes, they need treatment right through their lives. So if they develop it at age 30 or 40, let's hope they live to 80, but all that time they are taking resources from the health sector. That's not to say we resent that. We are here to treat, but also we are here to improve health, and that means where we can prevent, it is our obligation to prevent, and by doing that, people become less of a burden on the health services. Sales of sugar-sweetened beverages are rising every year in South Africa and are projected to rise more over the next 3 or 5 years. So this is a problem of consumption which is driving obesity, which is driving non-communicable diseases, and instead of reversing, we are growing, and that is leading to growing burdens of chronic diseases. And as I say, the more we have, the more of a burden it becomes on our health service, the less likely we are going to be able to do NHI properly, because for NHI, a healthy population is going to allow us to treat those people who need to be treated far more effectively, because we'll have less people to treat. I'm not sure how well you can actually see the slide, but people love the slide because very often the public is not aware of the fact that sugar-sweetened beverages have tons of sugar. Or, sorry, I should be not using tons unscientifically, have lots of sugar, such that a Coke, for example, has about 8 teaspoons of sugar, a Fanta about 13 teaspoons of sugar. So can one imagine that would have what one would have a cup of tea and put 13 spoons of sugar in it? It's unlikely. Okay. So when we consume sugar-sweetened beverages, we are consuming large amounts of sugar. It's not only great stuff. That's the best drink you can have is water. Probably true. Right. Now, it is not just obesity that we have to worry about. We also have to worry about dental caries. And dental decay is caused by acid or low pH levels in the mouth that dissolves the enamel of the teeth. The low pHi of the drink dissolves this enamel and creates holes. Therefore, any form of acid in the mouth will dissolve enamel. Sugary, acidy drinks have double whammy on demineralization of teeth and bacteria glycemic produced lactic acid, which is formed by sugar. And this is what it does to your teeth when this process happens. And I'm sorry that these slides are not better than they are. The production here is pretty poor. But the acidity of Coke, for example, is not that different from the acidity of vinegar or the acidity of lemon. And can you imagine drinking that much vinegar or that much lemon and see what the impact on your teeth is going to be? Okay. The bottom one is pool acid, by the way, and we're further away from water than we are from pool acid when you're taking a Coke. So what are some of the risk factors for dental care? Dental caries are the most preventable chronic disease and very expensive to treat. And I have to come back to this over and over again, is that these diseases caused by sugar or sugary sweetened beverages cause diseases which become a major burden on the health service. And our saving could be extremely high if we were able to reduce these disease impacts. Okay. During financial year 15-16, over 2.5 million teeth were extracted just in PHC public health facilities. Okay. Why do we need to extract so much teeth? Yes, because we don't have the facilities to fill them, but we could prevent many of these from happening through various interventions, but primarily primary prevention. People talk about fluoridation in water, or fluoride toothpaste, and so on. And yes, those are important secondary preventive mechanisms. But we can move to primary preventive mechanisms. In other words, we can prevent the need for these things and prevent the caries from happening in the first place. A report on the Children's Oral Health Survey indicates that caries prevalence in 4 to 5 year olds is over 50%, and in 6 year olds, it's 60%. The burden of untreated caries was reported to be 46% in 4 to 5 year olds and 55% in 6 year olds. We can't afford this, honourable members and public. Some of the risk factors and consequences for NCDs. Let's get back to the obesity issue. It's one of the major risk factors, as we've said. And overweight and obesity increases the risk of NCDs from 4 to 8 times for diseases such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. So in other words, if you're overweight, your chances of developing an NCD are 4 to 8 times higher. Moderate obesity is associated with an 11% increase in healthcare costs, and severe obesity with a 23% increase in costs. Productivity is also compromised. This is an important bullet, I believe, here. There was a study that was done by the American Chamber of Commerce on quite a number of different countries around the world, of which South Africa was one. And they found that 6.8% of our GDP is spent on absenteeism, what they call presenteeism, in other words, being at work but not being fully at work, and early retirement, accounted for about 6.8% of GDP, and much of this was due to non-communicable diseases. So you can see how illness impacts on the economy, not just in terms of the healthcare costs, but in terms of the costs of growth and development and a thriving economy. In children, increased school absenteeism is mainly due to tooth-related problems. Preventable. Okay, so the World Health Organization did a review on the impact of fiscal policies, because that's really what we're talking about here, on prevention of non-communicable diseases. And they did a meta-analysis of 11 systematic reviews on the effectiveness of fiscal policy interventions for improved diets and preventing NCDs. And they showed that the evidence was strongest and most consistent for the effectiveness of sugar-sweetened beverages taxes in the range of 20 to 50%. So they looked at a whole range of fiscal measures, whether this was for... Well, they have done studies whether it's for alcohol or tobacco, but they've also concentrated on sugar and particularly sugar-sweetened beverages, and found that fiscal interventions are a particularly important way of preventing NCDs and saving on costs and promoting development. The most cost-effective interventions to address diet, physical activity and obesity, they looked at a whole lot of different things that could be done to reduce obesity and to reduce NCDs. And they found that food taxes were one of the most cost-effective ways of reducing NCDs. So something like physician consulting was quite an effective way of preventing NCDs, but the cost of it was far, far higher than an intervention which looked at taxing sugar-sweetened beverages. Another important cost-effective thing to do is to reduce salt intake, but we're not there, we're on sugar. And as I said, fiscal policies for reducing sugar were found to be extremely cost-effective. And the next slide shows this too, that... We, I said to some colleagues a little bit earlier that we've probably been very poor as the Department of Health in giving some of this information out, and clearly we haven't given the information around salt out because we actually have been acting on that also quite substantially, and we have regulations already around that. But but you can see that the most cost of interventions to address obesity, right on top there, is fiscal measures. Such as tax. Then it goes on to food advertising regulation, food labeling, worksite interventions, mass media campaigns. You know, people say all you need to do is inform the public. Well, the science suggests that that is important and is necessary, but is not the most cost-effective way of reducing obesity. We have to do it. Obviously, we have to do it. And I must say, from the health department point of view, should we be able to pass the sugar tax, we hope that some resources will come to us such that we can actually increase our information. But that's another story as well. Okay, but it is important that we don't just do this. We want to do this within a context of a whole number of interventions. So what is the government responsibility on this? Well, the World Health Organization recommends that national governments should develop policies.
Just very quickly, you've got about 4 minutes left, yeah. Right? If you could. Just to alert members, we will have the departments here all the time. It's more important to hear stakeholders. So if you can just round up, please.
Okay. Perhaps I should just emphasize that this is not for us the only thing that needs to be done. We fully realize that this tax needs to be done within a context of a number of interventions. It's a very critical intervention, but there are many, many things that we as government can do, are doing, will do. There are other things that the private sector can do, will do, we hope, things like reformulating products and so on. It shouldn't be an option to a tax. It should be in addition to a tax. What we need to do is all work together towards better development in our country. And we do that by making a healthier population. And we would like to think that we are partners in this development so that we should all be having the same objective of having a healthier population. And we can all do that together. And we would like to think that through taxation and price, certain drinks which are unhealthy to the population become less accessible to them. That's really the crux of what we are trying to say, is let's make unhealthy sugar-sweetened beverages, which are the cause of much obesity, and people, when you hear the public presentations, you'll hear more about how this actually works and why sugary-sweetened beverages need to be identified specifically away from other sugar beverages because of their particular impact. But we can work together, and we want to work together, and we see tax as one of the very important issues that will help us get a healthier population, and with a healthier population, better development, better productivity, a thriving society in which we can all live. We don't want to punish anybody. We want to work with people, and we think that the way of doing this is through us all agreeing to evidence-based interventions such as taxation, which have been shown to affect health behaviors. And we can do that in South Africa, and we want to do that in South Africa. Okay, maybe let me stop there.
You want to say something quickly? 2-3 minutes maximum, I'm afraid. You're fine. Okay, just to explain now that more people are here, the chairs, I explained to those of you not who heard you earlier, Nilwa Dunjwa, the chair of the committees on sick leave, and Comrade Fish and myself will be chairing. The understanding between us is that, and the two committees presumably, that this will ultimately end up with the finance committee. It'll be a tax bill if it's anything at all. And so our committee has to take responsibility. But obviously we can't do it on our own. If such a bill does appear before the committee, it'll have to be done jointly with the health study, the health portfolio committee. And so we've agreed on a process. So this today's sitting will be co-chairing, which essentially means that both the chairs will pipe in and manage the meeting as we see fit. But primarily the first half, the co-chair of health will take responsibility, Mr. Masalela, Amos Fisher, as many of us know him, and I will deal with the second half mainly, but we will both intervene. Also to say that I know members, Momo, you don't need 30 minutes, right? 20 minutes is enough. I have also promised, for those of you who know me in the Finance Committee, not to natter. I'm not going to blabber. I'm not going to tell you what my great-grandfather's quirks were. There isn't the time. So, and the chair here will ensure that I don't. We want to focus on what people are saying. Secondly, can I urge, especially Finance Study Group members, that today it's 3 minutes maximum that anybody can make an input, because we've allocated half an hour for each of the sectors. Five submissions, half an hour discussion. Also, we'll take into account that people who've spoken will not necessarily be given a chance to speak again until others who put their hands up have been acknowledged. We'll also take into account that there is multi-partyism in our constitution and parliament and norms, so we'll give some latitude to the smaller parties to speak more than the... If you're not happy, tough. No, to Vicky. Let's actually abide by the rules, right? You have no more rights to go to the rules committee. The norm is clear. If you're from a smaller committee, then the person concerned will have more opportunity to ask questions than if you're from a majority party. That's fair. And Vicky, if you have a problem, go and speak to the speaker. There isn't the time. So let's move on. There it is, 20 minutes, and that's it. And then my brother here is going to take over chairing for the first half mainly. Nobody, by the way, is going to be allowed to speak for more than 15 minutes. It is not fair to others who are here. Moreover, people have flights and whatever. So in short, we are going to be timing you with the clock on my cell phone here, and comrade, fix your cell phone, okay? So you will have up to 12 minutes, stakeholders, and we'll tell you you've got 3 minutes left, and then 15 minutes is over. Thank you. Over to you.
Yeah, before I start, just put a weighing scale out there, the very modern one which measures your weight and your BMI and everything, and then people can talk. But,
Chair, I think you've heard from Health, and I'm going to run through this slide pretty quickly. We've actually got two separate slides. We're going to run through both quickly. One deals with the socioeconomic impact study as well. So I'm on the first slide, the background. We don't have to go into the background. I won't go into, just get to, yeah. So Chair, obviously just to say, Treasury is only moving on this, the first slide, is only moving on this proposal to tax sugary drinks, and I should add, it is not to tax sugar, it is to tax sugary beverages, given just what our policy in health is. And this was announced by the minister in the 2016 budget. And I should add, upfront, we are not saying a measure like a tax by itself will solve the obesity problem. In fact, it's going to take a lot to deal with the problem of obesity. The tax itself has to go with a complementary set of measures, with education, with making sure schools don't stock some of these beverages, etc. With labeling, you need those. And I think a good example is when the first democratic government actually took a stance on smoking, and aside from us having your tobacco excise tax, the Minister of Health, Suzana Zuma, at the time said, thou shalt not smoke in this room, because before 94, I'm sure you could smoke in this room. And if you wanted to smoke, you even had to go outside. Okay, so you need those sorts of measures. You need education and so on. So upfront, let's say, this is a start. But let me say this. Once we talk tax, suddenly people notice. Whether it's a carbon tax, whether it's this tax. And people start asking questions. So we say to our colleagues in health, now's the time. Educate, educate, educate. And let's deal with a complementary set of measures. So I won't go with all the other issues. We've consulted after the announcement. We published a paper, which I don't know if members have seen, in July for comment. And we will continue to deal with these comments. In terms of our process, the minister will then announce, having had the first round of consultations, how we responding to those comments from a policy perspective, which the minister will do in the budget. Move on. I'm not going to deal with some of these slides. I think they've been dealt with. But let's just say this approach is not new. If you look at the number, you can just go to the next slide just in interest of time. Or do you want to talk through this slide quickly? So basically, I mean, the use of fiscal measures to promote health, we're saying that's this is not a new issue, and globally there's a stance to start looking at fiscal measures to deal with those issues. And the fiscal measures can take the form of excise taxes or subsidies, one to deal with the unhealthy food, and the other one to deal with the issue around healthy food. And the role of excise taxes is mainly to deal with the externalities related to the unhealthy food, and basically to compensate for the negative effects, and also to look at influencing consumer behavior by changing the relative price between the unhealthy and the healthy products. That's why we're talking about excise taxes. There's an issue that has been raised about basically then if you are going to be introducing excise taxes, what level should you be introducing it to have a meaningful impact? I mean, that has been addressed by the Department of Health. I think just economic perspective, of course, we put a tax because we say there's a negative externality, to use economic jargon, i.e. these, like smoking, if you smoke, society doesn't pay, the person smoking doesn't pay for the full cost that's there for society. And that's the role of the tax, is to, in a sense, adjust for that price to some extent. Now, to look at examples, this is growing all over the world. You've got the UK more recently, you've got Mauritius on our continent, you've got Mexico, which is a very interesting example. If there was time, it would be useful to talk about and look at Mexico. France, there's many states, Cecil says, in the last election, aside from making a terrible decision to elect a particular president, there were good decisions on sugar. So as we move on, there's lots more examples. In terms of the tax itself, what we're proposing is that beverages that contain added caloric sweeteners, you want to talk through this language, okay? I'll just put it there. I'm not going to go through it. And I should add, it's not just the sugar that's there. It could even be the natural sugar, because it gets us to the issue of fruit juices as well, which we excluded in our paper. 100% fruit juice, what do you do with that? So we want to measure the amount of sugar. That becomes the tax base, effectively. And the tax rate that we have is at the rate of 2.29 cents per gram of sugar, which equates to about 20% on 1 liter of Coke. By way of example, a liter of Coke has about 106 grams of sugar, or how many spoons did we say? 6, 7, 8? It means that the tax rate will be around 2.42 per liter. Okay. The administration of this tax will be done through the Customs and Excise Act as a levy, so it's done at the point of manufacture or imports. Our initial paper had 100% fruit, vegetable juice exemption and unsweetened milk and milk products. I think on the fruit juice, we are open to just having heard comments. It's something we are still debating, but we are looking at including 100% fruit as well. But again, it's open to the consultations that will process, that will continue. Now, many drinks actually aren't labeled. If they don't label, we will assume that they have the highest amount of sugar. Okay, so it will be in their interest to actually state that they put sugar, and that needs to be obviously SABS or somebody needs to check it out, that those measures are correct and we don't have a car emissions type scandal when it comes to sugar. Move on. I should say, and we can come to the revenue issues later, but we're not looking at, obviously we don't like earmarked taxes, but generally, for various reasons, because it may not be enough for the health function, may be too little, it may be too big. In South Africa, we have huge imbalances when you look at the RAF, Road Accident Fund, or the UIF. We see this as a budget issue, and certainly, I think what we've talked about, it's not just in the health department, as I've said, you need basic education to deal with education, you need to make sure DTI gets the labeling system right. I think my sister, it is DTI that finally does it, or is it health, the food labeling. And I've said to people also, you need a real simple labeling system, in my view, red, green, whatever. Because at some of our age, to even try and read what's written is impossible, even if you have a magnifying glass. So I think those are the issues. You want to just add on to the revenue? Is there anything we can cut through this quickly? I want to go to the socio-economic impact. Afana, do you want to?
From the public finance side, as National Treasury, we must align budget allocations to the activities and goals and objectives in our national planning documents. And there are a number of national policies and planning documents that highlight the importance of health promotion and health promotion as a national priority. So as government and society as a whole, we are not doing enough to address health promotion. The next slide. And government has committed to addressing health promotion and supporting health promotion programs targeting NCDs. And this is critical to gain much-needed public buy-in for the SSB tax, averting the high cost of obesity on the health system and the economy, and contributing to outcome two, which is to have long and healthy lives of all South Africans, especially for the poor. And the SSB tax is an extremely pro-poor policy, so we need to highlight that. Also, SSBs are pervasive and readily available in South Africa. As you know, that industry has multi-billion rand marketing budgets to promote their products. And industry is not necessarily anti-health, and will change as consumer preferences change. So that is why health promotion is and education is critically important in this process. And also the important role of government to push in industry to implement healthier food and drink options is important for the SSB, and the SSB tax has a major role in this. The next slide. Okay.
Sorry, Afana. Okay, so Chair, I think just to take up from what she said, the idea is not obviously to say we don't want a particular drink or so. The issue is you hope that even industries that are currently there will actually create substitutes that are healthier, will have less sugar, and so on. So we're going to get to the socioeconomic study. Those are important issues. To what extent is there substitution? That's important. Just in terms of our slides, we take comments, we briefly just go through what the comments we received, our initial responses, and just in terms of process, if you get towards the end, what we're looking at is, as I said, the minister will make further announcements in the coming budget, and then we will introduce legislation in the coming tax legislation, whether it's the wage bill or the TLAB, and then we'll use the customs and excise act schedules. I won't go into the rest. You have the slides. I want Cecil Morden just to deal with the socioeconomic study that we've conducted.
Chair, I'll just take 5 minutes. I'm not going to go through all of these slides. Just go to, so that's the overview of the documentation. Just go to the next slide. I think here, Chair, the importance of using market-based instruments to deal with some of the challenges that we face in economics, being the free rider problem and externalities, is an important background document. Just next slide. It's important for us to just contextualize the role of the tax as a price. So there are something like five factors that determine demand. So price is but one factor. There are other things like prices of related goods, a very important income of the buyer, tastes of people and expectations. And when we do an analysis of the demand for a particular product, it's important that we look at all of these factors. And you'll see in the analysis that we've done how important income is in determining the demands of this particular product. Next slide. Just skip this one. And so in constructing a demand, this is a typical demand curve would look like. As price goes up, one expects quantity demand to drop, and as price comes down, you expect quantity demand to increase. And this is an important concept in trying to understand the relationship between price and volume. Next slide. And also then the relationship between the price of a particular good and what we call either substitute or complementary goods. Next slide. In terms of the analysis, this is just a methodology that we've used, give you a brief background of how we've gone about trying to understand this market. Next slide. Next slide. And these are some of the data sources that we've used. So we've gone in extensively looking at various data sources. And I must say, one of the challenges that we face is to find good quality data doing the analysis. Next slide. I think the colleagues of health has already alluded to this, and you can just get an indication of the significant increase in the volumes of this product over time between 2001 and 2015 data is available. Next slide. Next slide. At the same time, in real terms, the price of soft drinks has actually come down. And so it became more affordable for people to actually buy this product. Next slide. The slide is a bit unclear, but you'll see here on the hard copy that in terms of volumes, for off-trade, your volumes increase around about 5% per annum, whereas your price, real price, has only increased by about 3% per annum. And that is an important mechanism that has been used to push volumes in this particular market. Okay, go on to the next slide. I think just skip the slides. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. Chair, this slide is a bit busy. Go to the previous slide. But this gives you an indication of our estimates of what we call price elasticity and income elasticity. And there was quite a big issue when we dealt with industry around the assumptions around price elasticity and income elasticity that was used in the various studies. Because of limited data, it was very difficult, but I think we've got some robust figures to use as some benchmarks to determine what's the impact of the change in price. Next slide. On this slide, we just give you an impact, very detailed, of both the formal sector and the informal sector, what the estimated impact of the tax will be. I'm not going to go through detail, but on average, we expect the 20% tax would result in a volume decline of about 10%, and in terms of income, it was around about 5%. So that's an estimated impact that we have quantified. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. So, Chair, in terms of numbers, these are the estimated impacts that we've seen. The jobs impact is way, way less than what we have seen in the newspapers. And the point that we make right at the last bullet point is that if industry reformulate their product, the net decline in volumes and job losses could be reduced significantly, if not entirely prevented. And this is the important thing, that if the sugar content of these products are reduced, the tax implications is reduced, and volumes will not be impacted that much. I think I'll stop there. That more or less summarize the main results of what I wanted to say.
Just to conclude, I think what we're saying is the tax must be seen as part of a set of measures. We're not saying that the tax by itself is any panacea. We're saying the complementary measures need to include health promotion, education, labeling, a whole range of measures, and certainly on the budget side, those will have to be dealt with as well in some way. And we're saying that whilst sugary beverages aren't the only cause of obesity, it's a start. And it's going to be a long road, and there's going to be no easy victory. So we'll stop at that point, Chair. Thank you.
Are you done? No, thanks very much for the two presentations from the two departments. The health was presenting the policy perspective around the challenges of health lifestyle, which results towards an increase of non-communicable diseases, which has got a huge impact into ordinary people. And then finance was presenting the proposal in terms of what process needs to be followed around the proposed taxation of sugar sweetened beverages. So these are the two presentations for members to engage upon, make clarity seeking question, comment. But as the chair has indicated, this is a finance matter at hand. And once the bill is introduced, so finance is going to lead the process until towards conclusion. For now, it's a general discussion around what policy perspective is government taking around this matter as a means of trying to deal with the challenges of the increase or the explosion of non-communicable diseases in South Africa. There'll be one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Thank you, Chair. What a complex matter with the limited time we're given, 3 minutes. So I'm not good at utilizing 3 minutes. My colleague said she'll give me her 3 minutes, so I've got 6 minutes effectively. So, because, you know, it's not a peripheral matter. It's both policy and mathematics, and I want to raise few things, but let me start by saying this as a comment first. When we do studies, whether it's done by the World Health Organization or any other institution, we need to be careful at the type of studies we make that might have a different impact in an African country and in a European country, because the economic environment is not the same. So I will try to come closer home in terms of the situation in South Africa in terms of how we look at. And I'm happy National Treasury made a statement in advance to say that the intention actually is to tax byproducts of sugar, not necessarily sugar as a product. But we'll come to that. First, let me talk to this. And I'm going to use an anecdote, Chair, because it's very important to make an example of what I'm talking about. The other day I went to buy olive oil, right? There's different types of olive oils. You have a virgin olive oil, which is pure, and there's some combinations of canola, sunflower, and olive oil. And normally what I do, maybe I'm one of the few who are advantaged to look at the ingredients, to look at what's in there. And I realized that they've used a product called hydrogen peroxide. So those who know what hydrogen peroxide is will understand, and I look at the quantities they've utilized to cleanse up the olive oil. Then I call the manager to explain to me in quantities, in percentage terms, how much was utilized of hydrogen peroxide in that olive oil. He could not explain to me. A manager of a retailer could not explain to me. And then it reminded me of a content is something that was utilized in Acha at some point, which was a debate. And I realized that actually, in terms of labeling, these matters are not clear. And then I will always look at the glycemic index. Well, I'm talking like this because I'm diabetic, so I pay much attention to the contents of every item I utilize. I try very hard to look at the glycemic index of some of the products that are on our shelves. And then you'll realize that they're not actually labeled properly or explained for the consumer to understand in South Africa as it is done in other European countries. Now, when you use the Hugh study in this country, it means we might, and I'm talking to you, lady, we might find ourselves in a situation where we're not given the correct information. Now, when you start to deal with lifestyle diseases, but you start with taxation and don't look at the information and the education, we might miss the mark of what we want to achieve. So I'm saying that. So let me go to the questions.
Is
it God?
With due respect.
Okay, I shall them.
I hate being a policeman, as you know, right?
I shall them, Chair. I'll come back.
It's 2:51. Can I raise something? Members are not looking at the program. This one is only a 15-minute. I think it's unfair to civil society, really. We're here to hear them. Those are going to be, you know, I hate doing this, really, frankly. But here it is, right? Comrade Fish is slightly, let's say, cautious because he's not sharing finance. But I know you, and you know me. People have spoken here for 22 minutes. Let's not cover that. Right, so here it is.
I'm going to shelve it because I've got a number of questions.
Right,
this
fine.
Is a very important debate.
Yeah, we're coming back to this. Yeah.
We cannot just...
Yeah, no. Can you suggest any other way we do it then? In other words, we're finishing at 6 p.m. with a 15-minute lunch. Okay, here it is.
I'll go right at the end.
Right. So basically, this is an initial... Can we get something clear? This is an initial foray. It's merely to get a feel for what the issues are. We'll be sitting endless hours. Now, the two chairs would like to know, having discussed this thing endlessly, have you got, any members got another proposal on how we manage this? If eight of you speak for 3 minutes, that's 24 minutes, when are they going to reply? So, open to members now. Can you suggest a way that we can finish at 6 p.m. today without restricting your time? Okay, here it is. Explain to us. Members, how will you do it? Right, so fine. So it's 2 minutes per person. And so what we're going to do is we're going to finish at 6:15 p.m., okay? So that we give them a bit of a time to reply. So here it is. 2 minutes. Here's the clock. Okay, can you monitor it? Because you're independent. Right, so 2 minutes. 2 minutes starting, right. And don't use your full 2 minutes, please. I've been very good by my standards, Pinky. I haven't interrupted you or anything. So I've started. So in short, over to you. You're number two. Thank you. Whoever is number two, right? Start. Here we are. You can switch your own iPhones on, the stopwatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do agree that the people who've come here to talk to us are the people we should be listening to, so I'll be as brief as I can. And indeed, we're going to spend a lot more time with National Treasury on this matter. So the point I just want to make very briefly is that I think that there will probably be no one who denies that there are health issues to be dealt with. However, there are implications for a tax which we have to consider very, very carefully. And so we will be listening and we will be considering those implications of putting, putting a tax on it. And the impact on the economy, on the impact on jobs, and we've had a brief comment from National Treasury about the impact on jobs. Just a quick question from National Treasury, for National Treasury. Has this tax been referred to the Davis Tax Commission? And if not, is it going to be? And has a full impact assessment been done on it?
Could I just echo what my colleague said, that the presentation on health and establishing the relationship between excessive sugar consumption and obesity and other non-communicable diseases is indisputable, firstly, and that secondly, there is a need for some kind of intervention, and the question is what? And what is being proposed here is a tax. I don't think that's the only intervention, and it may not even be the most effective intervention. But let me put the question to Treasury. And I'm going to put it as a simple point, that if the purpose is to raise general revenue and it's hooked against health, which in my view presents a interesting an important but relatively weak case. If it is simply to raise general revenue, the purpose, in my view, is immoral. And you would be able to convince me otherwise if you were to tell us that you have some smart ideas about how you're going to distribute the revenue in a way that, in fact, helps health. For example, that there would be a special appropriation for the Medical Research Council to do proper longitudinal studies about the relationship between excessive sugar consumption and lifestyle diseases. So I think we're going to have an interesting day today, but it's very important that the integrity of your purpose is unquestionable, because if you've soon been trying to raise general revenue, in my view, that's immoral.
He missed it.
Thank you, Chair. I think my colleagues have covered me, but I just want to, I need clarity on how far has the Department of Health invested in health promotion, because that's not happening. We've got to learn to educate and empower our citizens so that they take their, you know, decisions, informed decisions. If they want to be obese, using so much sugar, let that be, but let them have the option of taking a decision on their informed decision. And the worst is that the poor of the poorest don't have no idea of what's happening here. And how will that, how will this reach them? How will they know that in a tin, in a liter of Coke, there's 8 teaspoons, and they should be, you know, how are the poor going to benefit out of this tax? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just to check with the Treasury, the unintended consequences that this will bring to the poor. A good example is a farmer in KZN who has just got his farm through land claim. And because he saw what Hewlett has been getting, he thought it will be another Hewlett. And this comes in. We understand it's for beverages, not for sugar. But you know, big business will also say, we are no longer doing offtake from you. We are reducing on sugar because there's a tax issue around it. And our people, many women work in the farms. They'll be the hardest hit in terms of some of these things. That's the first one. Two, you see the plastic law that we also introduced on environmental issues. People who buy at ShopRite and carry plastic are the poor, because they must buy there and walk to the taxi. Initially, ShopRite was not making profit on plastic. I'm just giving an example on that. But today they are making extra money, even on plastic. And who are the hardest hit? Poor people. So some of these things, really, we have to think through and see what is the best thing we can do. Because from what health is saying there, they are not saying because Coke has so many teaspoons of sugar, therefore reduce on the teaspoons of sugar. In a groovy, there must at least be 1 teaspoon. They must say in a groovy, there must be 1 teaspoon. If you go beyond 1 teaspoon, then penalty. But health is not saying that. They are saying drink poison and then we'll tax big corporates. Tell us, reduce, let them reduce on the amount of sugar content in that thing and then be able to, so that you don't. And I mean, I drink Oros and I can control the amount of sugar in my Oros. I don't know which.
Pinky, it's 207, please. I'm just the secretary here. Thank you.
Chair, thank you, Chair. Oh, thank you, secretary. Notwithstanding the importance of imposing taxes to address our own tax revenue streams challenges, the challenge that I have is that is tax, the tax regime, the best, or the tax instrument, the best tool to deal with, to address the health concern? Shouldn't we be looking at what Pinky is talking about, the regulatory regime? Because to me, the regulatory regime then sets the national standard on health, on what is allowable sugar levels, and what is not allowable. And I think that way we will be able to deal with the root cause of our concern. unless we are saying we are worried about the fact that the industry is going to tell us that, you know, the sales will go down and what have you and what have you. But really, do we care if our concern is about health? Because we need to put our people first. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Mm-hmm. And you know, if it was possible, I would also suggest joining what the Honorable Makosi has already raised, that the politics of the groovy. That if it was indeed about maintaining healthy lifestyle, that along the way we ought to even be thinking about some radical measures, including criminalizing on some of these things. You know, I know that it might sound out of line, but I'm just saying if really we're acting in the interest of the public, we should be putting regulatory measures to make sure that we measure what is the sugar put in these beverages and be able to say if you go beyond, this could be. Because tax alone might not necessarily be the only measure to be advanced to try and address some of these things. But also, it is going to be important to zoom into the issue of jobs. You see, we are about the creation of jobs, social relief to our people, and all of that. So when you introduce measures, it is also important to create public clarity that some of these measures are not going to further dislodge our people and take them out of their jobs. I think that is the one message that we need to be driving out there. Thanks, Chair.
No, thanks, Chair. I'll be very brief. Light referring to the impact on GDP and job losses less severe and estimated 5,000. Now, that will typically be the people who are at the very end of, you know, the social class. Now, those are the very people who are dependent on the healthcare system which we currently have. So it's either they will lose their jobs and then become another burden onto the healthcare system. What are the ripple effects of job losses? What's the impact of poverty on health, on hunger and starvation? You're dealing with obesity on one side and you're moving towards now creating another problem. So let's weigh those issues. You're taking 5,000 people out of jobs. How many people are they feeding? You've got families which will have one person feeding 10 people. The ripple effect of this is one job loss, 11 people in poverty. So can we, might not be today, can we get a breakdown of this study? I want to zoom into the impact of the job losses because I think that's very important. So what I'm pleading for is that we must adopt a Hambakahle approach on this particular aspect. The final one, Chair, is I keep hearing the notion or the rhetoric, it's not a silver bullet, it's part of other things. What are other considerations that have been considered to deal with obesity? Prevention is better than cure, public education and so on. So the tax regime may be an option, but it needs to form part of the broader basket and spectrum. What are those programs that have been put in to ensure that we actually address this holistically? Chair, finally, I want to highlight what Honorable James has said, that when this tax has been collected, I'm interested in how it's going to be spent, and whether it's going to assist the health sector, or it's just going to be general expenditure. Because if that's the case, then I don't think it actually effectively addresses the issue. Chair, I decided to charge a bit of your time because I'm part of the smaller people. You must get 3 minutes.
Thanks very much. You want to come back?
I thought maybe because other people had a chance to. I requested.
Okay, Chair. Can we be clear so that there's a misunderstanding? Each person has got up to 2 minutes now, and then 3 minutes later. But the members of the minority smaller parties can only speak for 2 to 3 minutes, as the case is. However, they will get a chance to speak more than once. Unlike with the ANC, because then the ANC will completely dominate. So I think I was misunderstood. No. Yes, but when it comes to individuals, this is the way we've done it before. So until I hear otherwise, look, until the speaker phones me, or phone the speaker and discuss it with her. Right. Right. Can we move on, please? And can people stop? This is a serious matter, really.
And can we realize that this is the beginning of endless hours of discussions? Endless hours. You're going to get sick of discussing this issue, right? So this is just the start. So can we, between, okay, can I hand over to you? I've done my secretarial job.
No, thanks very much. Can some that are standing there, there are two seats
time,
here,
you
can come and take
spent,
two seats here?
Spent,
there's one there as well. So that it doesn't, we'll know that you're not a member in any way, so, but it's fine, you're going to be sitting there. Instead of standing, there's
yeah,
one there,
chair,
there's two
chair,
here,
yeah.
There's another chair so, here, can be pulled off.
Hmm? What's your name? Patrick McLaughlin, UK. Hello, Patrick, who are you writing for?
Okay, we'll then hand over to the two departments. Amongst yourself, you will have 3 minutes, 3 minutes.
Industry, a lot of black
who starts? Yes.
Okay, Chair, very quickly, let me assure Honourable Wilmot, if you needed more revenue, we just don't give you fiscal drag. It's easier, nobody squeals. The amount of revenue we get with the sugar tax or carbon tax is really, and the work that goes into it, we must be crazy if we raise these things for revenue purposes. So I can assure you, the tax is not there for revenue purposes. It is there, and I've made the point, as a basket of measures that we need to have, and it's driven by health policy. So that is the main reason. However, to the extent that you raise revenue, we don't like earmarks. It's a bad public finance principle, and we can go into that. But certainly, we take the point that you need to fund a set of activities, whether it's health promotion and the other activities that go education and so on. With regard to the Davis Committee, Mr. Lees, we've not referred it to, but you know, the point is this is a simple excise tax. It's straightforward, I think. I'm not sure what more they can add because you need to look at the health issues, but we don't have a problem. Nothing stops the Davis Committee from commenting on it. With regard to, you know, let me say that when there's any tax, there's always, you know, when there's a new tax, there's always big doom and gloom stories, and I'm not saying it can't be right once, but, you know, somehow life settles. There's the issue of job losses that we've dealt with, for example. Again, it depends on your assumptions. If this depends on how substitution takes place, depends on a range of other assumptions that you make, and we can deal with those issues, I think. And obviously, if there are losers, how do you deal with those who are losers from a particular policy? But no policy is going to have only winners and no losers. Hopefully, you hope the benefits exceed the cost. Are there any other tax issues that we need to, that I've missed?
The slides on the socioeconomic impact is pretty comprehensive. We've got detailed report, which we'll make available to the committee, that underpins that particular slide. The regulation and the tax are not either or. It's very important. You use both regulations and the tax. Like Momo has talked about in the case of tobacco, for example, there are significant regulations coupled with an excise tax. In the case of the sugar tax, we foresee the same initiative, that there will be regulations, there will be health promotions, plus the support of the tax. One option of combining a suggestion of a particular benchmark, say for example 1 teaspoon or 2 teaspoons of sugar with the tax, is to say that if the sugar content is below a certain level, there will be no tax, and if it's above a certain level, there will be tax. That's one option in terms of the design that we're looking at, which we can explore as we go forward.
Can I just end by saying, I don't think we want to look at issues like criminalizing and so on. I'm not sure those things really work. People have choice. It's a question of, I think, a range of other measures that you have to deal with. The last point I want to make is the tax system as a whole is progressive. However, there may be specific taxes which may be regressive. So, for example, we suspect that certainly we know that when it comes to the excise tax on tobacco, it's regressive. That doesn't mean we don't do it, because you also get poor people not to smoke. Now, I think those are difficult issues, certainly, that what's the impact on the poor, because obviously you almost find that bad foods are cheaper than good foods. How do you deal with those issues? I don't think we can answer those, and we're not saying we have the solutions, but those are issues certainly that need to be looked at.
Thanks, Hal.
Just very briefly, I feel that perhaps members are not appreciating what a good mechanism taxation is in changing behavior. And when one looks at tobacco and alcohol in particular, as price rises, consumption drops. There will be evidence shown here by others who are making presentations that actually show that when price rises, consumption drops, and the same will be true in sugar. And this is the main reason why we are doing this, because when price rises, through taxation, we will change the behavior of people, including poor people. Sugar sweetened beverages are not an essential product. You can choose them or you can leave them. And we are hoping that poor people, because it becomes too expensive, will not take, or not take nearly as much as they're currently taking. So it's not increasing the burden on them, it's reducing the burden on them.
It's making our day very difficult, you know.
I know there is a large number of questions that has not been answered. And because we're saying this is an initial process, once the process starts rolling in full force, we'll come back to those questions because they have not been responded to. We'll have an opportunity to come back to those questions. I've noted a large number of them that has not been responded to, but fine. We'll come back at some point. Today is not our day. Our day is going to come. Today is the day for the public to be able to make their own presentation. So we'll then move now and allow now an opportunity to the stakeholders to give them an opportunity to present. We'll start with the UCT School of Public Health and Family Medicine. I'm not sure whether they are here. If they are here, they should come here to come and make a presentation, introduce themselves, and then give them an opportunity. We'll give you 15 minutes presentation. They will then be followed by, just to be ready, by Vets Health Living Alliance, and then they will then be followed by Society for Endocrinology, Metabolism, Diabetes South Africa, and then it will be University of Illinois. Then it will be UWCU School of Public Health. So these are going to be followed in that fashion. Each one will be given 15 minutes, and members will then be given an opportunity then to ask clarity-seeking questions to those presentations. I'll hand over to UCT.
Staff members are unavailable, astonishingly, today, so we are managing. I'm doing a lot of that work myself, needless to say, but there's a limit. I don't have technology skills. Yeah, okay.
Am I missing? Three
out of the five are missing. For various reasons.
The answers to which were in the presentation. Yes.
They're absent. They might be affected by the non-communicable reasons.
Whereas we should just be quizzing those who've made a presentation. Yes, I understand that. But when they
talked about
health measures, and Melvin was there, clear. Taxes,
no, they're absent.
Let me first speak to it.
They don't understand or they don't listen.
I'll hand over back to you. You introduce yourself and then indicate who's going to take us through.
Maybe
if you are
I have too much knowledge. But they don't listen. Right? Yeah, and you can't legalize or regulate the people's thinking.
Thank you to the chairs and to the committee for this opportunity. I'm Professor Onyema, I'm a medical specialist in public health and associate professor of the School of Public Health at UCT. And I appreciate this opportunity to speak to this hearing on the sugar tax and the public health case for this. So just briefly, I'll give an overview. I thank my colleague from the Department of Health on the strategic plan in terms of NCD, non-communicable disease control. We'll speak to the rationale of some of the stuff that's been raised earlier on the population-based versus an individual-based approach to addressing this burden. I'll present a little bit of data around consumption patterns and association with weight gain, and end off with addressing the importance of a life course, which is not something we've touched on today. So very briefly, the strategic plan that was mentioned for the prevention and control of non-communicable diseases has a key priority: prevention of NCDs and promotion of health and wellness at the population level, at the community level, and an individual level. And I'm highlighting that because the approaches to addressing at those different levels are very different. We know that a lot of the key factors that influence health, the health determinants, lie outside of the health sector. And we know that we need this multi-sectoral approach to address this. And we also know from evidence within South Africa and outside that we need this population-level approach. So what do I mean by a population-level approach? I want to make the distinction with an individual approach. And an individual approach focuses on either affected individuals, vulnerable individuals, susceptible individuals, or high-risk individuals. So why does this person in front of me have diabetes? Why does this person obese? And how can I educate them? How can I reduce their weight? That is an individual-level approach. And if you can imagine a curve on a population, what we're trying to do is move the people at the end of the curve down towards the middle, to healthier weight limits, say. A population approach rather focuses on the actions that influence the environment. And when I talk about environments, I mean whether they be the physical environment, whether the economic environment, or right down to actually the societal norm environment. Because we know that at the individual level, in addition to your inherent susceptibilities, we have at the population level these factors that influence behavior. The aim of population approaches, far from being in an individual one-on-one case, is to shift the whole distribution of exposure. So and remove the underlying cause. So instead of looking at an individual level, so what is your BMI? What is your susceptibility to diabetes? We're looking at, as a population, where are we in terms of our burden of disease? Where are we in terms of our exposure? And how can we shift the population, not just the people at high risk, towards a healthier end of the curve? So a key aspect of this is shifting the societal norms. And we know from evidence from not the non-communicable diseases that shifting those norms are crucial, because you can affect the societal norms, you can expect the supply and exposures adapted to those norms, and when you do that approach results in the maintenance that is required and the effort that's required at an individual level being significantly decreased. So this is not saying that it replaces the need for health education, the need for health promotion, but that actually by shifting that whole distribution of the population, by shifting that exposure, that need and that pressure towards the maintenance at the individual level is reduced. So I don't think it's been argued here today that there is a need to intervene, right? So we all agree that that health is important, and we all agree this burden of disease is important. So what kind of intervention? So things that I've heard around, can't we just get people to move more? Because we know that urbanization, we know people are getting more sedentary, etc. And indeed, physical activity matters. This is the point normally I'd ask students to take five seconds and everyone and get up and do star jumps, but I won't put you through that today. But we know that consumption matters more. The Global Burden of Disease Study, so this is a study published in Lancet looking at over 150 countries across the globe, including South Africa. We know that in terms of the contribution to disease, poor diet generates more disease than physical inactivity, than alcohol, and than smoking combined. we know from diabetes prevention interventions, so these are studies that I've done to look at in people who are susceptible to diabetes, can we intervene using different interventions to actually try and reduce their risk of diabetes? And we know from this that moderate activity alone does not decrease your risk of then proceeding on to full diabetes. We know this. Secondly, the source of calories matter. A calorie is not just a calorie. If in terms of how you consume, what your body does with the calories differ depending on the source of calories. So sugar calories promote fat storage, they promote trigger to hunger compared to more complex carbohydrates and fats, say, and proteins. So we know that even in the absence of obesity, a high sugar calorie intake is associated with these metabolic disturbances. So you see with high sugar intake, you can see it in the liver in terms of what your body does with it and fat storage in the liver. And we know this is associated. And thirdly, speaks to a combination of these two. Both physical inactivity and diet are required to prevent NCDs. But I just want to make the point that a focus on physical activity alone, even at the recommended levels that we all struggle to achieve now, at the expense of looking at more population-based interventions on sugar, does not effectively address obesity at the population level. And I think it's important, as we consider today, we're not thinking about what do I think, what will I do, because this is a population approach. We're not looking at just the people at the end who are susceptible. We're looking at how to shift the entire population such that our burden of disease is significantly decreased. So why tax? Alternatives have been suggested, and I include this before the discussions earlier. Consumer education to balance calorie choices. Systematic reviews look at all published studies on a particular topic. We know that that health education alone, and I'll present some data from South Africa, and it's important to contextualize that data. We know that such intervention alone lack evidence for effectiveness in terms of reducing consumption. If we're honest with ourselves, you know, the things that we do and what we know, the no-do gap, as they say, there is a difference, and it's not just about education. So strategies to focus on people making healthier dietary choices and individual interventions to get to exercise, you miss the heart of the problem. This is important. It's great. We need to get people. We need to more health promotion. We need that. But the heart of the problem is the underlying cause that shifts this entire population burden towards this epidemic state and the unequal distribution of factors that support the opportunity to be a healthy weight. I think that's important to remember. This is one of two data slides that I will show. This is published data on the intake of sugar-sweetened beverages in 9 to 10-year-olds. That is South Africa. What's the only other country that is higher than South Africa? The USA. It is the only higher. This is what the data shows. This is our children. And it's important to contextualize. This is not happening in the absence of health promotion. This isn't happening in the context of life orientation of health promotion. It's happening in the context of interventions around looking at food provided in schools. This is happening in the context of physical activity. This is happening in the context of a lot of health promotion, which we need to ramp up. But this is where we are now. And if we look at just on the right-hand side here, products per person per year, look at the global average, and look at the South African average in 2010. Then look at that number as you go down in the preceding years, how much more we're going up. We need radical intervention. We need a population intervention. We cannot afford to delay. The second slide, just looking at sugar-sweetened beverages consumption related to weight change. So this is a study, 800 individuals followed up for almost 5 years across South Africa. They found that 3 out of every 10 adults put on more than 5% weight over this period of time. Every additional serving of sugar-sweetened beverages per week increased the risk of gaining more than 5% by 3%. And those that had 10 or more doubled this risk. This is South African data. This is not data being extrapolated from elsewhere. And this result really highlights the consistently association between SSB intake and the weight gain of over 5% from largely low-income settings. And this further supports this need to look at more population-based approaches. My last slide is a life course considerations. And this is something that I want to stress, because when we talk about the impact of a sugar tax on consumption, yes, we are talking about people now. Yes, we're talking about you, and we're talking about me now. Yes, we're talking about our children now. But we're also talking about the future generations. And what I want to highlight, what essentially this highlights, is that there is a connection between the health of a woman of reproductive age and the health of her child. So multiple of studies have shown that offspring of obese mothers are more likely to be obese. How are we ever going to address this? We're just constantly chasing our tails. It's not just about now, it's about the future as well. And we've also shown that interventions that focus on reducing the glycemic load in pregnancy is associated with reducing that risk of offspring obesity. So these are already the next generation that are not born already, that we have to already start thinking about how we're going to promote their health when we could have prevented them from being at higher risk in the first place. This intergenerational transmission of overweight and obesity is not just in the parent. There's also around the social norms, around the nudges around how we consume. It's not just genetically passed on, because another study looked at between parent and adolescent. And if you have at least one parent, you're more likely to be overweight or obese as an adolescent. If you're both your parents are overweight or obese, that likelihood is even greater. This is just as a side, because what we're focusing on today is sugar and linked to obesity and cardiovascular disease. But I just want to highlight that that obesity is more than just the physical, and because there's consistent evidence linking maternal obesity to lower cognitive function in children. So we have to think that there is a much more holistic, beyond just the physical and the obese. There are implications intergenerationally that are beyond just diabetes, that are beyond just the risk of obesity, but actually move into cognitive function. So just to summarize my key points, firstly, population-based approaches are needed to impact on NCD intervention. We can't dance around just these individuals. We just simply don't have the time. The use of price and tax strategies for public health interventions in general, but specifically addressing obesity, is backed by a considerable body of evidence. And I didn't touch so much on that, because in the next few presentations, my colleagues will present on the impact of SSB in other settings. We know this consumption, thank you very much, is unacceptably high in our children. It's unacceptably high in our country, and is associated with weight gain. We know this. And we know that when we think about obesity, we're not just thinking about now, we're thinking about transmission across generations. If we can't afford it now, how are we going to afford it if we're breeding that the next generation that is at even higher risk of obesity? I won't touch on the right to health and the state obligation now, because I also know some of my colleagues in the afternoon will touch on this, but there is also an obligation in terms of, in the context of an epidemic and an endemic, which is what we're going through, the obligation of the state. So just to summarize my last slide, Chair, South Africa has an extraordinary burden of NCDs, and this requires intersectoral action from all of us. The use of tax instruments to shape behavior public health is not unusual, it's not atypical, and it's not inconsistent with our constitutional values, and we have seen this work in the past in South Africa and elsewhere. And where taxation provides an upstream effective measure to reduce the burden of disease, the state has an obligation to consider these measures. And we lastly commend and strongly support the Treasury's proposal on SSB tax to address what is a really complex health problem with multifaceted consequences requiring a coordinated intersectoral action. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Now, don't influence us by clapping hands. We're not in a rally here. No, thanks very much for the presentation. Honourable members, this is an opportunity to pose clarification questions. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay.
Chair, thank you. The presenter insisted on a community-based approach in terms of dealing with the issue. I wanted to make a suggestion because I come from a thinking that poverty is the main driver of what we are faced with in the current conjuncture. So it's not only a question of lifestyle, but if we don't address poverty, and if we say a community approach, it's not just an individual approach where I decide that I want to curb diseases. So in an environment where people are poor and they are forced to buy products and commodities that are cheaper and probably that are affecting their health, what should be the approach in this context?
Prof, is there any rationale behind you focusing? Obviously, I know that you came here strictly to comment on the tax, this tax, proposed tax, sugary beverage tax thing. But is there any reason why you are not saying anything about the regulatory environment? Because to me, I don't think a tax on its own is going to be able to deal with the scourge that you've just highlighted to us.
She's just said it, doesn't her?
Thank you very much for that really quite evocative presentation. My question is a follow-up on the earlier question, is that, I mean, sugar tax is one option. You can also regulate sugar content as a regulatory matter. And so I'm a bit surprised that you asked that. And my second question is that is to ask whether you put this to the Faculty of Health Science at UCT on a vote, because you're speaking on behalf of the faculty. I'm a member, honorary professor in the Human Genetics Division, and I don't remember this being put to the faculty member, to the faculty for a vote.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you for the presentation, Professor. Quite an interesting presentation. Just you presented like a public health specialist. I was even tempted to ask other things, but my question would be just to find out if we have looked at any mechanism perhaps to reach out. We agree 100% that we need to educate the community, and I think it's one thing that's always been a big challenge. We want to educate the community, but have you looked at perhaps mechanisms that we can use to reach out there? Because a lot of people, we can say here that the people must change, but how do we change the people? I know it's not your job, but maybe you have thought about it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll give you 2 minutes to respond.
Thank you. I'm going to try to address those in 2 minutes, the excellent questions. Firstly, the question around context of poverty. I think the purpose of highlighting the population approach is exactly that. So when I mentioned the environments, there are different environments. So there's the physical environment, there's the economic environment. And it's really crucial that when we're thinking about these population approaches, I think the key word is multifaceted. And what will be presented later in terms of different interventions is in the context of knowing we have different multifaceted approaches to address this. What do we do first? What do we second? What do we do third? I absolutely agree in terms of we can't come across as punishing people without putting in measures to this come across like we to support in terms of healthy options. So the environment is critical. But we cannot neglect, and this is something that even my fellow physicians often make, obviously not public health physicians, is at an individual level, we often live it down to this choice. I don't actually like the term lifestyle because that implies some sense of choice that sometimes isn't there. So the evidence in terms of the different types of interventions looking at what is cost effective to do show that the fiscal measures are cost effective to start off with. And I think a colleague from the Department of Health presented those different options, but we cannot just look at that. I focused, and just to the others, I focused on sugar tax because I had 15 minutes, and that's what the nature of the public health of the public hearings were. I have an hour talk on the different approaches that we can employ. But the key thing is that this is incredibly cost effective, and the potential impact of what we've seen in other settings is just not something that we can ignore. And that is the context. Second question around that relates to that, the regulatory environment. So that's absolutely, and what was mentioned around, say, for example, with assault legislation, there's been things we've put into place. Again, just to reiterate, the cost effectiveness of the different, because that's what we're talking about here is not where do we, which do we choose and which is the ones that work. What we're talking about here is in the context of this background burden of disease, in the context of this economic environment, what is the most cost effective at a population level? And that's why I focused on the sugar tax. But it's not by any means the only, it's not the silver bullet, as we keep calling it. But it's shown to be cost effective, and it's shown to significantly impact population vulnerability to obesity. Health sciences, I put because we have multiple departments. I take your point, and I stand as a correction in terms of health sciences. But I am representing the School of Public Health, but also have had input from multiple departments within the health sciences, within the Faculty of Health Sciences. And lastly, in terms of other mechanisms to educate, an example that has been. What is really scandalous about that that slide in terms of consumption of children is this is a setting of the incredible effort that's been put in to education and to healthy lifestyles. I was part of a project with the West Cape Department of Health looking at how do we create healthier lifestyles in school-going children. It is an incredible intersectoral project that takes health, that takes education, that takes social development, that takes cultural affairs and sports, and looks at providing opportunities for children in school-going children. And it shows it increases physical activity. It involves provision of food. It's a lot of this is happening in the context of that. That needs to keep going on, and we need to, using evidence, look at how better to hone that craft. But we know that it's not sufficient.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll move to the next, but the approach that we want to take now, it's honorable members, because of time, we'll allow all of them to present, and then you note each issue that you want to raise as they present. Then from there, we'll have a discussion. That is a VETS, Society for Endocrinology, University of Illinois, and then UWC. They are going to present one by one. Then you'll note whatsoever that you want to note. Then at the end, then we'll then allow you to then ask questions. Okay, can we start?
Honorary Chair, honorable members, thanks for the opportunity to talk here. My name is Sandeep Ruda. I'm a clinical endocrinologist representing the Society for Endocrinology, Metabolism and Diabetes of South Africa. I'm also a teacher at WITS and involved in a lot of public health issues. I'm going to be speaking as a clinician on the ground. I'm not a researcher. I'm a doctor, South African trained. I've worked across the country from all the big hospitals in South Africa, Groote Schuur, Charlotte Maseke, Helen Joseph, Chris Hani Baragwanath. But I've also worked in the rural areas of South Africa, in Elim, in Rutan, in some of the small farming villages where I remember this very government passed community service laws We used to work in little clinics where we were short of drugs like insulin, glucophage, things that treat diabetes, cholesterol-lowering tablets, where patients who were suffering diabetes, who suffer amputations, heart attacks, strokes, had very little access to tertiary level care. And I know the struggles of clinicians on the ground out there trying to help people at the salvage level. So what we're talking here today is about policy that can change pathophysiology. You know, the word doctor means, comes from the Latin word docere, which means to guide or to teach. It doesn't mean to heal. Because health is an intrinsic nature of the human being. We are all born healthy. You drink your mother's breast milk, we get fresh air and water and good food from the ground, and we're basically healthy. So when we become unhealthy, it's through things that have been put into us. And I just want to narrate this little tale in a very simple way. I'm going to put some science into it in a very simple way, that you can understand the plight of the human being. There's a lot of talk here today about numbers and finance and economics and all of that. But at the end of the story is a human being, a South African, a citizen of this country that's suffering. And I just want to speak to that for a little bit. This is a nice story in the Daily Maverick highlighting the plight of an individual patient coming to Charlotte Mateke Hospital needing an amputation, you know. And it talks about our struggles every day. Endocrinologists are doctors that deal with diabetes every day in our country. And there are very few of us. The rest are physicians, GPs, and primary healthcare nurses in small clinics. And this little story, because of time, I'm not going to go through it, will highlight some of the issues we have in terms of drug shortages, patient numbers. You think about the number of patients that have to attend hospital and are disabled through this disease, the diseases of diabetes and the complications, obesity and the complications, and how much of time they spend away from work. We're talking about jobs and job security, etc. But all of these patients who suffer from these diseases are unable to work and become state dependent on grants and that sort of thing. So I'm just adding a little bit of story to all the numbers that everybody here is processing. The food landscape in South Africa has changed. There's a lady in this picture who's a human being who is surrounded by so much misinformation. And this is the key to understanding what the South African has to go through today, all right? We talk about nannying through policy, but how many of our population have been nannied through misinformation, being led to believe that the products they consume are good for them, good for their health, through sexy images, through name and fame, through music, through pictures of Santa Claus is also a myth. We've seen the advertising since December that has just massively increased. And this is playing to psychological manipulation. We know this from the days of Eddie Bernays. There was a time when people would earn money for their families, for sustenance, for shelter, and working to purpose. And then came the psychological manipulation of the nephew of Sigmund Freud through advertising, that we change people's attitude to living into consuming. Consuming things that we probably don't need at all. So this, I just wanted you to think about this human being who's supposed to be the chef d'oeuvre of creation, which means masterpiece of creation, now being numbed down into a simpleton that is unhealthy and fighting for their lives. We use the term in endocrinology, the endocrine disrupted individual. We study hormones. All your hormones are regulating your life processes so that you can engage the world. And what we're saying is that what's happening currently is disrupting that whole process and leading to the diseases we see later on. So we're all familiar with the usual suspects of disease. And people talk about this very easily because the vector of disease is so easily seeable, observable, and the disease it causes is very acute. There's Ebola, there's HIV, there's tuberculosis, and the latest on the market is the Zika virus. So because it causes changes quickly, we think about it and we talk about it and we address them aggressively. But the greatest trick the devil ever pulled up is making the world believe it didn't exist. The diseases we're seeing in terms of non-communicable diseases are driven by a more subtle enemy, something you cannot see and palpate immediately. Just like the beautiful thunderstorms we have in Johannesburg, when we see these storms, we wonder where did this come from. But for days before and weeks before, the atmosphere is being saturated with water vapor till it reaches a threshold, and then we see the big catastrophic storm, right? But when the water vapor is saturating the atmosphere, we don't see it happening. It's silent. And that's the same thing with non-communicable diseases. All of this is happening under our noses, and you don't know it. And clinicians like us are battling on the ground now, dealing with the fallout of this. Misinformation started a very long time ago, all right? And I want to speak to this because as a doctor, I use a lot of drugs to treat patients. And those drugs have been through rigorous trials over 20 years sometimes. Scientific studies, animal studies, and even human studies that are well regulated, ethically and morally regulated studies, before a drug comes to market to make it safe for use. All right. Now, I put it to you here that we have to search and prove that certain products are harmful to you. But these products here on market have never been proved to be safe for human consumption, ever. They serve no nutritional value. Food has no taste before it goes into the mouth and after it leaves the mouth. So all these things do is gratify 7 centimeters of muscle in the tongue and cause havoc in the long term. This is what it does. This is what food looked like. In Africa, we had food. We grew food. We lived with the land. And none of these products here come off a factory. This is the diet of the South African today. We eat a quarter, a bunny chow, and we wash it down. Right? We got to ask ourselves, what is the information we're feeding into our body? This God-given body, what is the information we're feeding into it? And what does the average South African know about these things? This is the thing. In a country where education standards are poor, there's difficulties with education at the moment, we know this, right? We're expecting the consumer to make choices based on what knowledge? This is the key to ask, what's going on? So the problem is, in this landscape, we start seeing obesity, type 2 diabetes, everyone's alluded to the big numbers of these epidemics now, heart disease, even independent of weight gain, there's now studies to show that consuming sugar-sweetened beverages at a young age leads to cardiovascular disease later in life, independent of weight gain. There's impact on growing bones as well. We all talk about the body mass index and why is that important. It helps us stratify patients. Body mass index is weight over height squared. And if we use that as a measure, the higher your body mass index, the higher your risk of developing cardiovascular disease. So we risk stratify, and the higher you are, the more aggressive I'm going to be in my treatment of the patient in terms of the number of drugs we use. And remember, the higher you go up here, the more interventions you need. You need a cholesterol tablet, you need a blood pressure tablet, you need multiple agents to treat diabetes. And if you've already had an event, you need prostheses, you need things for amputations. So think about these things. There's a big fallout at the end that we are seeing on the ground. These are the numbers, and I'm going to skirt through this very quickly because everyone else has alluded to them. I just want to highlight that we're reflecting first world numbers without first world resources to deal with these epidemics. That's very important to understand. And across the world, the numbers are increasing. Very important, the previous speaker spoke about, and I'm glad she highlighted that, is that the women of our country are very overweight and obese, amongst the highest in the world. And it is very important that at the childbearing age, if a woman's body is not healthy, it is having significant impact in the long term. And we need to think in terms of cause and effect. I'll show you a slide or two on that in a second. We are number one for obesity in Africa at the moment. And if you add to that overweight, that's the numbers there. The thing that really bugs me is that, you know, we talk about these things like we skirt over the numbers. I remember when we were taught about diabetes in medical school that it was a disease of aging. When you were older, you developed diabetes. And this is true to some extent. The older we are, the higher we are at risk of diabetes. But we're starting to see it in teenagers. Huh? The youngest type 2 diabetic diagnosed was 3 years old in the United States about 2 years ago. And this is driven by diet, right? So why is that happening? It's because exposure of young children to an abnormal environment is starting at an early age. Our great-grandparents and grandparents only got exposed to these products at a much later stage in their lives. The direct link between drinking a sugar-sweetened beverage and the risk of developing overweight and obesity is highlighted there, up to 27% and 55% in children. These are the diseases we are treating in our public hospitals. And remember, it is the poor of this country that still access the public hospitals. Pulmonary disease, fatty liver disease, gallbladder disease, gynecological problems such as infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, we see on a daily basis many, many patients. Heart disease, and even cancer. How many people here know that many cancers are driven by obesity and the food we eat? And so many cancers can be reduced, or the risk of developing these cancers can be reduced by just simply changing our diets and addressing these issues on a mass scale. Now, we got specialists to deal with each one of these systems, And we have a shortage of specialists in the country. You know that, right? Super specialists and specialists in this country are at a shortage. GPs and interns are struggling to deal with very complicated disease at public health levels with very little resources. So these are the diseases we treat every day. These are the numbers again of diabetics in the world. We may argue that there's less in Africa than the rest of the world, but the trajectory is upwards. 109% rate of increase up to 2030, so we have the highest rate of increase. We also have the highest mortality rates. So people that die from diabetes in Africa is higher than anywhere else in the world, and that's something to think about. These are the complications of diabetes: gangrene, blindness, kidney failure requiring dialysis. Do you know what dialysis costs in the public sector at the moment? We have to turn patients away because we don't have enough dialysis units to cope with it, right? So how does a doctor make the decision as to who gets help and who doesn't? These are entirely preventable diseases. Stroke leaves people debilitated to the extent families can't take care of them. So that man that has to go out to work now has to stay at home to take care of someone. So we talk about job losses. I think we have to factor all of these things to weigh in on this, the ultimate conclusions. And heart disease.
3 minutes left.
So association with cancers, ultimately all common cancers are increased when you are diabetic. I'm going to just go through this. Drinking one sugar-sweetened beverage a day increases your risk of type 2 diabetes by 26%.
Sure.
Why is this so important? Because it's empty calories. And this is, I just want to stress this very importantly. The fat that we put on around the waist through excessive consumption of sugar, all right, causes metabolic mayhem. So when you drink a can of soft drink, you don't feel full. Your brain goes into addictive mode. It's exactly the same process that happens with cocaine addiction. You do not feel satisfied after drinking a sugar-sweetened beverage, so you end up eating more the whole day. So it cannot be part of a healthy diet. At the end of the day, you are stimulating hunger the entire day, which is why patients have so difficulty stopping drinking Oros, for example. So this causes insulin resistance. And before you even develop diabetes, there's inflammation, there's high cholesterol, there's high blood pressure, there's coagulopathy, the dental problems that come with it. It's all happening silently because you're carrying this waist fat, and you need to know this. The only time you're going to find out is when you get diabetes, heart attack, stroke, etc. Right, that's the teeth of children in our country at the moment. Very important that they alluded to. What children eat determines their long-term health, and it's very important not just from diabetes and heart disease, but cognitive dysfunction and educational performance. We're seeing what's happening in universities and schools these days. We need to address nutrition at a young level. And those that were undernourished who go and consume these products are even at greater risk of developing diabetes. So this serves no nutritional purpose. This is what I said about added sugars leading to cardiovascular disease. You can Google these studies. And this was very recent from this week, secondhand sugars. When a mother consumes sugar, it's affecting the fetus. And if you breast milk while consuming sugar, it's what we call secondary sugar, like secondary smoke. It's appearing in her breast milk and affecting children in the long term in terms of obesity, diabetes, and very importantly, cognitive dysfunction. It's a form of addiction. World Health Organization, someone's going to speak to that. Based on great studies, they have set limits. I think the limits need to be stricter. Where is the evidence? Sorry, there's a line there that these products are good for you. I have not seen that evidence. I'd just like to say then in ending, these are the effects. Lots of people are going to speak to this smarter than me. The future is a continuation of the past modified by the present. And this policy is going to modify the present to change the future. This policy is not just a policy on paper. It impacts the human being on the physiological level, the macrocosm affecting the microcosm. And just a 1% decrease in BMI can decrease diabetes, coronary heart disease, cancer, and increase disability-adjusted life years by a massive amount. There comes a time in the history of a nation when we must do what is correct rather than what is present. South Africa has always been a laboratory of a new world waiting to be born. That's what Nelson Mandela said. So why not write a new story that the world can copy rather than keep copying the world? Ubuntu is a person through other people. I am a doctor. You guys are policy makers. But we can lift our nation because of what we know by just simply applying our logic. It's as simple as that. So I thank you for your time. I ask you as a clinician representing SAMHSA and clinicians to think about this carefully. on a bigger level and think about those individuals out there that we're trying to help. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
No, I said it's not a rally.
Thanks very much for the presentation. We'll go to that. Priceless.
We will influence.
Yeah, not to horror speaking.
Thank you, honourable members and chairs. My name is Professor Karen Hoffman. I work at the Witt School of Public Health, and I run a group there called Priceless, Priority Cost Effective Lessons on System Strengthening, looking at where we can get the best buys for health in South Africa. So let me just summarize, if I say nothing more, that this tax will do the following things. It will save lives, it will increase life expectancy at low cost, it will send a public health message to counter marketing. We have been told for many decades now that we need these products, sugary drinks. Do we need them? Okay, they will open happiness for us. Okay, this is not what we need. Okay, it will also avoid further impoverishment for poor families. Dr. Ruda has discussed already today how these caregivers and breadwinners are affected very seriously in this situation. And poor families are just getting poorer from these diseases. It will avert huge costs to the economy, and that's been discussed, and I will mention it again. So as you can see, and I won't dwell on this, obesity prevalence is rising in South Africa. What is more interesting is that it's not just moderate obesity. It's severe obesity. Okay, it's huge. Okay, there are healthy life years lost. Look at the slide on the right. In 2015, it is just incredible. Okay, the health system is burdened by these NCDs, which are pushing up costs. It's increasing, as you can see on the slide on the right here, just looking at the private healthcare costs by BMI, which is a measure of obesity. It's increasing expenditure in the private sector. It's increasing expenditure in the public sector. It creates more disability even than smoking. So when somebody is diagnosed with cancer, on average, they die after about 2 or 3 years. When someone's diagnosed with hypertension or diabetes, and let me just say, I have people in my family with diabetes. I'm not immune from all of this. The impact is when you have diabetes, you will live for at least 5 years after that diagnosis. And think of all the disability that will happen in that time. And as has been alluded to by the Treasury, it imposes externality costs and further poorer service in the public sector. It will affect NHI. So this is a picture on the left of government expenditure, health expenditure, from Treasury documents between 1995 and 2015. We're in a hole. We're in a deep hole. The hidden cost of sugary drinks is we're on higher purchase here. Buy now, pay later. Doesn't matter. It tastes good. Okay? There's a 50% increased health cost for obesity in the 54 to 69 year age group. And what is actually happening in South Africa right now is that the public purse is subsidizing our drinking of sugary drinks. Okay? Just look at the yellow here. This is what's happening to diabetes. The prevalence of diabetes just in the private sector. Okay? Diabetes prevalence, 25 cases per 1,000. The change in prevalence over 5 years, 2008 to 2013, 70%. Close to 70% of us are getting this. Okay? This is what it's costing us. Okay? The total health expenditure on diabetes in 2010, between 11 and 20 billion rand. As a percentage of expenditure in 2010, 7 to 12% of the health expenditure. In 2030, it will be 14 to 26. We can't wait. We can't debate. We must just do it. Okay? The macroeconomic impact of NCDs, there's lost wages of adults due to death and disability. There's significant costs of mortality on households. It creates a poverty spiral. Okay? Early retirement due to ill health will cost GDP 2.1, is costing GDP 2.1%. Absenteeism and presenteeism, 4.7%. If you're diabetic or hypertensive and you have to be absent from work, it costs twice as much if you're obese than if you're not obese. Okay? If you're what is presenteeism? It means when we go to work, but we're not really doing our jobs. May as well not be there. Okay? It's costing us. Okay? So I'm trying to put for you, Dr. Rudy explained what it does to our bodies, and I'm trying to show you what it's doing to the public purse. Okay, you've seen this slide. I'm not going to dwell on it. I just want to say one thing about these excise taxes to decrease the consumption of tobacco. Yes, it's true. We still see people smoking. But you know what, honorable members? It has decreased by half. South Africa is a leader. Okay, at the turn of democracy, 1994, South Africa brought in a tobacco tax. Okay, they have decreased consumption of tobacco from 40% to 20% of the entire population. This is a historic moment. Okay, let's do it. Okay, this shows you, the black line is showing you the consumption of cigarettes decreasing and the taxes increasing. Okay, this is what will happen with the sugary drinks. Will it be the whole picture? Will people still drink sugary drinks? Absolutely. Okay? But they will drink less. So, just to reiterate, this tax is consistent with our national priorities and will fulfill our international targets. Okay? The National Development Plan, we've heard about, highlights the promotion of health. The South African Constitution, Section 24, is a right to an environment that is not harmful to health. What is harmful to health is having hundreds of billboards around the country in poor areas urging us to drink this stuff. The National Strategy for Prevention and Control of Obesity identifies sugary beverage taxation as an objective. We are being asked today to implement these strategic objectives. Okay? The UN Sustainable Development Goals need to minimize the NCD burden. Without doing this, we will get nowhere. There is a growing global trend. It's true. We need information from South Africa, and I'm going to show you that. So at the Vic School of Public Health, our unit modeled the health impacts of a sugary sweetened beverage tax. We reviewed the evidence, looked at price elasticities, combined the evidence on elasticities and population survey data to estimate obesity reductions. Okay? And what we showed was the following, that the health impact increases with the magnitude of the tax. So the Treasury has said that we need a 20% tax, which in our calculations will show 250,000 people will be prevented from obesity. But the health impacts would be even more with a 30% tax. And let me say that our studies were very conservative numbers. The results of our study showed the minimum impact that could be achieved. It's much more likely to have a greater impact. And we also underestimated the baseline sugar-sweetened beverage intake on purpose. So this is a result you can see in this orange circle here. That's showing you what is happening. It's a mathematical modeling study of potential impact of a 20% tax. The people that are going to be most impacted are going to be the youth of South Africa, young people, 20, 24, 30, 34. These are the people that are drinking these drinks mostly, not all, but it will decrease the intake. And here's what's happening. As we are sitting here, as we are waiting, the cost of inaction is costing us dearly, okay? Sugary sweetened beverage tax sales are projected to grow year on year. This is, we did a study in 2013, by 2.5%. Now let me tell you, you're going to hear a lot of information over the next few days, or certainly over the next few hours. Industry is targeting the poor, okay? They have told us, they have told everybody that their growth market is in Africa, and in South Africa, it's the poor. Okay, right. So, just keep going. It's all our constituencies. We care about this, okay? The cost of inaction in the last 5 years has already, by the fact that we've done nothing, and sat down, we have done increased the obesity rates by 16%. 20% of this is due to sugar-sweetened beverages, over 250,000 people, and these are mostly young South Africans. So, whilst it's true that people who are more educated will stop drinking because they may or may not want to, we don't actually have a choice. We are trying to counter the fact that there is no choice being given to us. We are surrounded. Okay. Also, there's been a lot of discussion today already about regulation. Let me say that there is little evidence. There's been a lot of analysis done. There is no evidence that self-regulatory approaches are effective. Okay. We've done studies in 50% of the schools of Soweto. 50%. Okay. There are school boards which advertise sugary beverages. Okay. We were told 8 years ago from the industry that they would self-regulate marketing to children. You've now heard the information about how much children are consuming, okay, 9 to 10 year olds, primary school. We were told 8 years ago that this wouldn't happen anymore, okay? We're still waiting. So, a couple of comments about the proposed tax. Once again, this is the first step. It's not the only step. It will actually allow the industry to regulate, to reformulate. Okay, we're hoping that that's what will happen. It's not a silver bullet. We need to consider the revenue that would be raised for lots of things. There's been comments about for research. We think that it should be other policies in the National Obesity Strategy, for a health promotion foundation like they have in Thailand. It's not discriminatory. Anybody who believes that needs to see all the publications that we've written. The sugary beverages will impact health. It is pro-poor.
3 minutes left.
Thank you. The tax is very well designed. We would suggest that it actually should be 30%. You'll get greater health gains. And the use of the sugar content as a base will allow the industry to lower their own tax liability by offering healthy products. They will reformulate, they can broaden the range or reduce portion sizes. Yeah, they can advertise less. No, they won't. Let me say one more thing here, and then I'm going to end, is we're not alone in this view, okay? There are over 40 groups that have already signed on, okay? Top people in the world, from Harvard, from Oxford, from all over the world, who have done work in this area, okay? They are all supporting this drinks tax in South Africa. Let me say thank you, and let me just finish with 2 points. This proposed sugary drinks tax is a historic opportunity for all our citizens. It will significantly impact the targets of the National Development Plan and the SDGs. It's a win-win-win. It'll save lives, it'll cut healthcare costs, and it will generate revenue. Thank you so much for your attention.
No, thanks very much. The next one will be University of Illinois.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Frank Chalupka. I'm a distinguished professor of economics at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and I've spent over 30 years researching the effects of fiscal policies and other policies on health behaviors, things like tobacco use, excessive drinking, as well as diets in recent years. I'm going to take a slightly different approach than Dr. Ruger took, and I will present probably too much data, too many numbers. But I'm going to try to do a couple of things in the 15 minutes that I have. First, I'm going to give you some sense of what's been happening in Mexico, where they were the first country to adopt a significant sugary beverage tax, and what the impact of that has been over the last couple of years. And then I'll spend some time talking about the employment impact of these types of taxes. I'll talk about some of the general arguments that we hear about these taxes. I'll provide some specific evidence on the impact of these taxes in the U.S. and in Mexico. Then I'll also give you some examples from what happened in the past with tobacco taxes and other tobacco control measures in South Africa. So in terms of Mexico, this is a picture from a few years ago that looks at soda consumption across countries and obesity rates among adults. You can see from this picture that my country, the U.S., and Mexico were fighting it out for worst in the world when it came to the highest obesity prevalence rates and also the highest levels of sugary beverage consumption. The thing that's happened in Mexico, though, is that they've taken strong actions to try to reduce consumption, to try to promote healthier diets, and as a result, to try to reduce obesity. And one of the first things that they did was to adopt a significant tax on sugary beverages. So they implemented a tax of 1 peso per liter, which led to about a 10% increase in price on all non-alcoholic beverages that had added sugars. They excluded juices and products with artificial sweeteners from their tax, and the tax was collected at the producer level. The first thing that we want to look at is what happened to prices, and consistent with expectations, when the tax went into effect, the prices of the tax products went up. We saw some differences in how that tax was passed through on different products. We saw carbonated beverages, for example, increase by relatively more. We saw larger increases on smaller containers. And we also saw that there was some variability in the increases in prices across different regions of the country. In terms of the initial impact of the tax, looking at what happened in 2014, the first year after the implementation of the tax, we saw that it really started to have its intended effects. It did lead to significant reductions in the purchases, household purchases of taxed beverages, compared to what we would have expected to see given the trends that were in place before that. And over the course of the first year, we saw a 6% decline in the purchases of taxed beverages. And at the same time, we started to see consumers substituting away from those tax products towards other products that hadn't been taxed, in particular things like bottled water. And there we saw a 4% increase in the purchases of the untaxed beverages. We've heard a lot about the potentially regressive impact of a tax like this. This slide highlights what I think is a progressive effect. What we see here is that there were differences in how consumers at different income levels responded to the tax, with the groups at the lowest income levels being the most responsive to the tax. We saw reductions of 9% in their purchases versus that 6% average. And to me, this implies that there's going to be a very progressive health effect, that you're going to see the biggest reductions in consumption, and as a result, the biggest improvements in health in the most vulnerable populations. The other thing that's important to note is that we see that the tax is really having its impact on the population that we're most interested in seeing reduce their consumption, and that's the group that's consuming these beverages at the highest levels. We saw the biggest reductions in purchases among the heaviest consuming households. We saw a somewhat smaller reduction among the middle consuming households, and a relatively small effect among the households where they really didn't consume many of these products. So again, it's really hitting the consumers who are the ones that are at most risk for obesity and contributing to the economic costs of the problems. The other thing that we're starting to see is that the effects of the tax are growing over time, and I think this has to do with the changing social norms around beverage consumption in Mexico. What we saw was a 6% reduction in the first year. Over the course of 2 years now, we've seen a 7.6% reduction compared to what we would have expected to see without the tax increase. And when we look at the most recent sales data, this is looking at the first half of 2016, we're seeing again that this effect is getting bigger and bigger. A 6% decline in the first year, 8% in the second year, and an 11% decline in sales in the first half of 2016. And again, we've seen the offsetting effects with consumers switching to healthier products, in particular increases in bottled water sales. Consistent with the work that Karen talked about for South Africa, the expectations are that these reductions in consumption will lead to real health benefits. We expect to see about 189,000 fewer cases of diabetes, over 20,000 fewer strokes and heart attacks as a result, and almost 19,000 premature deaths that are going to be averted as a result of the reductions in consumption from the tax. And this has significant implications for healthcare systems, saving almost $1 billion in healthcare spending as a result. In addition to this, we again see that the tax is having its impact, reducing purchases, reducing sales, really affecting the lowest income and heaviest consuming households the most. The tax is also a very efficient way of generating revenues. So in the first year, the tax raised almost $1 billion in new revenues. And in the second year, it raised over $1.1 billion. As others have talked about, even larger taxes would have even larger effects in terms of reducing consumption and generating revenues. And if some of those revenues do get put back into obesity prevention programs, we would see even bigger effects on health. So I just want to acknowledge that there are a number of others that are the ones that are really leading this research. I'm part of an evaluation team that works with this group. But it's a really strong group, carefully evaluating what the impact of the tax has been. So now I want to turn to the employment effects. We've heard a lot about the potential impact of taxes like this on jobs. And what I want to do is provide sort of two sides to the story as to what's going to happen. The industries that we're talking about, not just the beverage industry, but we hear from the alcoholic beverage industry, we hear from tobacco companies, argue that their products, the consumption of their products, the production of their products makes a significant economic contribution, and that as people work in these sectors, they're going to spend the incomes that they earn generating jobs in other sectors. And when we start to look at the impact of these taxes on jobs, the industry tells us part of the story. They focus on what I call the gross impact. So they talk about how the tax will reduce consumption, that will lead to job losses in their sector, and then I think they exaggerate how much of an impact that has as it spills out through the economy. But what they ignore is what really happens on the other side. As consumers change their behaviors in response to the tax, change how they're spending their incomes, that's going to create jobs in other sectors. As the government spends its tax revenues, that's going to create jobs in other sectors. And what we see are that there are offsetting gains in these other sectors that really leads to basically no economic impact. And this is true of the studies that we've seen released in recent months here in South Africa. The Oxford Economics Study comes up with very large job losses, but it completely ignores the changes in consumer behavior and the spending of government tax revenues. The study by Econics does account for some of the changes in consumer behavior, but again, doesn't account for the industry or the government spending of those new tax revenues, and as a result, doesn't really reflect the overall impact on the economy. So if we look at what we know about the employment impact of these taxes, to date there's relatively little evidence. My colleagues and I published the first study in the U.S. on this, looking at what would happen in U.S. states as a result of a tax that increased prices by 20%. So very similar to what you're considering here in South Africa. We use a complicated regional economic model that really tries to account for all the interactions in the regional economy, looking at what's happening with consumer demand, looking at what's happening on the production side, taking into account how government is spending its revenues, to really get at that overall effect, overall net effect on the economy of a tax like this. We did this modeling in two states in the U.S. We did it in my state, Illinois. We did it for California, where they were considering a tax like this. And what we saw was that this would not lead to job losses. If anything, what it does is, in the end, results in a small net increase in jobs. We estimated just over 4,400 new jobs in Illinois and over 6,600 jobs in California. I think that this is confirmed by what we see happening in Mexico. So again, Mexico is the only country that has implemented a significant tax like this at this point. It's being very well evaluated. Part of what they've been looking at is employment, not just in the sector affected by the tax, but across the economy. Looked at commercial stores, the small retailers in particular, where there's a big concern that there might be lost jobs as a result of this type of tax. And then looked at the overall macroeconomy, looked at unemployment rates. And what they saw was that there was basically no change in employment in the affected sector, no change in employment in commercial stores, and no change in unemployment rates. So this is just looking at the employment patterns in the sugar-sweetened beverage and non-essential energy-dense food manufacturing industries. looking at the number of people employed, looking at how many hours they work. And what you can see is that things have basically followed along on the same trends that they were on before the tax was implemented, reflecting the normal ups and downs in the economy. We've actually seen increases in jobs and commercial establishments across Mexico since the tax has been implemented, again, following the trends that were there to begin with. And there's been virtually no change in the trend in unemployment rates as a result. So again, the takeaway from this is that there has not been any negative impact on overall employment in Mexico in response to the tax there. I spent over 30 years working on tobacco taxes. We've done a recent review of all the global evidence on the economics of tobacco and tobacco control. And part of what we looked at were these arguments around the economic impact of tobacco taxes and tobacco control measures. I just want to highlight one of the studies that we looked at, which comes from the University of Cape Town, the Economics of Tobacco Control Project that was there back in the 1990s, which tried to look at what the economic impact in South Africa would be of reductions in tobacco use or elimination of tobacco use in response to tobacco control measures, including taxes. So they did very much the sort of analysis that we did, looked at how consumers would change their spending patterns, looked at what happened with government spending, and what they saw was basically if tobacco was to disappear from South Africa, there would be an increase in jobs in South Africa as a result, a net gain of over 50,000 jobs resulting from that reduction in tobacco use. So again, we've summarized all this evidence with the real focus on the evidence from low and middle income countries in a recent monograph that was just released in the past month. This was the culmination of 11 years of work by hundreds of people around the world looking at all different aspects of the economics of tobacco and tobacco control. We have an entire chapter devoted to these issues about employment and economic impact. And the conclusion is that strong tobacco control measures, including significant tax increases, have either no net effect or a positive net effect when it comes to overall employment, given that any job losses in the tobacco sector will be more than offset by job gains in other sectors. Coming back to one of the other comments that's been discussed this morning, one of our other key conclusions is that when it comes to tobacco control, a comprehensive approach, comprehensive bans on marketing, strong restrictions on smoking in public places, public education programs, is very important in reducing tobacco use. But the single most effective policy we have for reducing tobacco use is a significant increase in the tax on tobacco products. To the extent that there are job losses in the industry, I think, again, we can learn some lessons from what's happened in tobacco, where governments have taken some of the revenues that they've generated from tobacco taxes and use that to help people who have lost their jobs in these sectors, tobacco farmers, people employed in tobacco manufacturing, make the transition into other alternative livelihoods through crop substitution programs, retraining programs, and so on. And I think probably the best example of this is what's happened in Turkey. Turkey used to be one of the biggest tobacco-consuming countries in the world, one of the biggest tobacco-growing countries in the world. Turkey took some of its tobacco tax revenues, helped tobacco farmers get out of tobacco into other crops, helped move tobacco manufacturers from employment in tobacco manufacturing to other productive activities. So again, to summarize, I think that we have very strong evidence at this point from Mexico that the tax there has been effective in achieving its goals. It's leading to significant reductions in sugary beverage purchases and sales, and it's having its largest impact in the most vulnerable populations, the lowest income groups, and among the heaviest consumers. We also see that there really is no net employment impact of these taxes. Job losses in the beverage sector will be more than offset by job gains in other sectors. And we've heard about some of the other economic benefits that go along with this, things like reduced healthcare spending, a more productive labor force that's going to lead to better development. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. We'll move to the last presentation in the academia, UWC School of Public Health. It will be the one that will follow. And then from there, we'll then give opportunities to then we will, what's the time? Yeah. We'll then, after that, break for lunch. And then from there, we'll come back and have a 15 to 20 minutes discussion on the presentation. And then from there, we'll move to the next category. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm representing School of Public Health. My name is Thandi Puane. I'm a professor at the School of Public Health, and I'm with my colleague here. Dr. Peter Delabelle is with me here. Other colleagues could not be here, Professor David Sanders and Mark Freyer. So we've involved ourselves in this conversation because of the global burden of obesity. If you look at this slide, you'll see that 1.9 billion adults are obese. And if you look at it, South Africa is the fattest nation in sub-Saharan Africa. You could see that we are at 63.9%, and other countries are below us. So we really need to be concerned about this obesity problem. So why do we really bother? If you look at this slide, you'll see that we have a problem of chronic diseases. Total deaths around the world, as you can see, is 58 million. And deaths due to non-communicable disease, 35 million. And from developing countries, deaths from non-communicable disease, 28 million. And 14 million of these deaths are from developing countries, and they could be prevented, which means that we really need to do something about it. So obesity is a risk factor for these chronic diseases. It has been linked to to growing burden of non-communicable disease. It has been mentioned already, including type 2 diabetes and some cancers and heart disease. So it's a problem. And the rising prevalence of obesity is associated with unhealthy diet, which also includes intake of high levels of sugar and among other things. There is scientific evidence that if you consume more than what you expect, you are going to be obese. We know, so we know that physical activity also contributes to obesity. But the intake of large portion sizes, unhealthy diet, all those things they lead to weight gain, which is associated with chronic diseases, as I've already mentioned. We are aware that there are other factors which are very important. It's not only a diet. Diet is part of it. We know that there are cultural beliefs, cultural perceptions, especially in the African culture. The woman has to be big. It's a sign of affluence, a sign that a husband is able to feed that woman. All those things we have to deal with. We know globalization. We know other things. So it's part of it. We are aware of those things. So what do we do? There is evidence. So when we look at research from other countries, we know that policy interventions have been successful in changing the behavior of the population at wide. What happens is that we are aware that people are consuming sugary beverages, and those things lead to obesity. But you know, if a person, poor person, goes to the shop. She wants to buy something, even healthy food. You get in, you get a pamphlet which says Jive or Coke is on special. Definitely the person will be tempted to take one of the liter or 2 liters and take it home. So now these population-based approach interventions, they are dealing with the cause of the cause. You know, people are obese because they are drinking a lot of sugary beverages, but what is the cause? So that making it easily accessible and affordable, it makes them to take more. So we have to deal with it. So these policy actions that have been taken somewhere else have been mentioned this morning. It includes taxation of unhealthy food, such as sugary sweetened beverages. I'm not going to deal with this because the previous speaker has mentioned, presenter has mentioned the experience from Mexico, so I'm going to skip that. But other countries as well, as those that are listed here, Finland, Denmark, Norway, Ireland, they have also successfully implemented the taxing of sugar beverages, and there is evidence that these interventions have led to the reduction of consumption of sugary beverages, and they have led to the reduction of obesity as well as obesity-related diseases. So we commend, we support the tax, the Treasury proposition of the tax on sugary beverages, but we propose also that these, some of the things that should be added in this are the following. We've got main 3 points. We say we don't need to focus on sugar, taxing of sugar beverages only. There are other initiatives, so we need to look at a wider approach. For example, there should be food labeling. People need to know when they buy, what are they buying, what are the contents of the food that they are buying. There should be a regulation on advertisement. Some of the things, people who are watching TV, there's lots of advertisement which tempt people to go and purchase or buy those things. There need to be reformulation of the food and drinks by the industry. And we need to have consumer awareness programs. For example, large portion sizes. People believe that if I consume a lot of food, it's a sign that I can afford myself. We need to deal about with those things. The perception is that if you are big, you are well respected, it's a sign of affluence, your husband is being praised. So we need to deal with those between the men and women so that we deal with those perceptions, because it might lead to resistance. So those things we need to take them into consideration, as well as what is important also, they need to be healthy food has to be subsidized so that people can substitute unhealthy food with the health food. The next thing, the revenue from the sugary drink should be used to promote health. It has been mentioned several times this morning. It's not mentioned in the policy how this is going to be used. So we feel that it needs to be added so that the population know exactly what are the benefits, what will happen to this money that is going to be taken. The proposed level of tax is okay. Yes, we feel it's fine, but also if it can be a little bit higher, I think it can help to achieve the Department of Health goals that are set on the strategic plan for reducing obesity and obesity-related diseases. So I think we need to take action. What could happen if we don't take action, if we don't reduce obesity? This is what's going to happen in the future. These are the things that will happen. Thank you.
No, thanks very much. I'll ask the chair to make an announcement as we've concluded the presentation.
The term chair, unfortunately, doesn't apply to me at the moment. I'm basically the manager of catering. Now, what has happened is Parliament actually has catered for 80 people for lunch, and I've been trying since 10 o'clock to make it up to 120, but Professor Isa Kumar, the gentleman in the back.
Ruda.
Sorry?
Ruda.
Confirms to me that never mind the sugary or other content of what's there, if we all eat modestly, we will reduce the prospects of dying by, what is it you said, 22%, 22.84%. So here it is. Given my considerable catering manager skills, we are now urging people to break for lunch as we have to, because some of us have sugar and other challenges, diabetes.